Session number 4814, reel 4.
Mr. Wyatt, reel 4.
Yeah, if the you wanted a favour from the Japanese, then you had to go up and ask him how his wife and family was in Japan or wherever he came from, and ask him how he was himself, and he'd probably say, "Oh, there's a cigarette," or he might give you a couple of bananas or anything from his camp where he was. But that was the only thing Tom ever saw. I'd probably done it myself, to get extra food because you were so hungry that you'd, you forget all those principles as long as you can get something to eat.
Could you tell me next how you came to move from Thailand?
We went up to a place, we're at the 226 kilo camp, that's way up in Thailand, near the Burma border, and we stopped there because the railway was more or less completed from our side, and then we went back down on our own railway we built. To Chiang Kai, where we were told that we were going to go to Japan. The fittest men would be taken to Japan. Well, the fittest men were the ones who could stand up. If you had malaria or even beriberi, you were still fit. It was only the ones that were more or less lying down that didn't take. And we went back to Chiang Kai, and from there we went to through Malaya again to Singapore. We got in these trucks, which was just as bad as what they were. Well, we was at Singapore. They were steel trucks, and as I said before, they were 27 feet long and 12 feet wide, about 35 men in. It was really bad. With the chaps wanted to go to the toilet to try and get out. Anyway, we got to Singapore early in the morning. And from there, we stayed a couple of nights, and a Japanese convoy arrived, and we were in there on the convoy. Oh, yeah, we went to Singapore, Singapore docks, wait for a Japanese convoy. Anyway, arrived, and we saw an old ship. It was evidently had been built in the Clyde, and from the Japanese scrap heap somewhere they'd got it. It was 5,000 tons. It was called the Osaka Maru, and the Japanese guards stood on the deck, and as we got on, we had to take up a large rubber bundle and take on board with us. And he stood at the top of a hold, a very dark hold, and there were 750 of us, and they tried to pack us in the hold, and we got in the hold. It was black, and there were shelves in the hold, and some chaps had to sit at the back of the shelves with their knees under their chin, and we get more coming in, and it was so dark that chaps, were beginning with the heat, were beginning to lose their heads and start screaming. And when they battened down the hold, it was just pitch black. And there was such a rumpus that run up the stairs to the hold and burst open the doors leading out onto the ship. And they got a bit afraid because they had to get us to Japan. In safety because of the work in Japan, so they let us go up on the ship itself, and during the daytime. But at night time we had to go downstairs back into the hold again, and the conditions down there were terrible because chaps was had dysentery, and again all the jungle diseases was coming out, dysentery, beriberi, malaria, and they were dying in the hold. And as they were dying, so they were put in sacks and passed over our heads in the dark up the gangplank onto the decks. And there they were given a burial at sea, just thrown over the top. somebody from Norfolk or somewhere, or from, you know, from Lewisham or somewhere, been thrown over the top into the sea. And there were some latrines, boxes, and they were used for latrines, and they were tied to the side of the ship. And you had to crawl out, if you wanted to go to the toilet in the hold, you had to crawl out over the chaps, up the stairs, and onto the ship, and get into this box, which was a kind of a toilet, and squat down, and the sea was underneath you as you went by. And if a wave, it was funny, but if a wave came up, it used to hit the box, hit you, and you used to come up out from the box onto the deck again. And the conditions there was terrible. The sun was very hot on the deck in the daytime, and then we had to go back into the hold at night. It was very cold, and chaps began to get a bit more, started to riot in the hold, and we had to we pushed our way up to the top. And we were on the ship for about nearly 3 weeks before we were told that we were going to go to Japan to work. And the convoy formed up all around us. And we left Singapore for Japan on the Independence Day, about July the 4th, I always remember that. We passed all the, there was about 30 ships in the convoy, and we hugged all the coast of Borneo and different islands until we got to the Philippines. And just before we got to the Philippines, there was an attack by an American subs on the convoy, and it hit one ship, and we could see it was all ablaze, but we didn't care, like. And when we pulled into to the Philippines, and we stayed there for another fortnight, and people were anyway, we pulled into the Philippines to await to refuel. And just out from the Philippines, we ran into a kind of a typhoon. The sky got dark, and the rain and the seas swamped over the ship, and we all rushed out from the holds and onto the deck. And I could see, like, in the distance, another ship, which was ablaze. It was a Japanese ship, and even I felt sorry for that, because it was just one red glow, what had been hit by the American submarines. And for 2 days we were tossed about in the sea, and all the decks got made awash, and the cooking utensils, the big fridges and which was there, and the quali we used to cook all the rice in were just tossed about on the deck from one side to the other, and we had to hold on, and it was just grey, and well, the feeling then of us that we couldn't have cared less, because we thought, well, let's get torpedoed by an American submarine, perhaps we can get picked up. And at that moment, the daytime came, and the winds and the rain and settling the sea settled, calmed a bit. And I went down looking for food in rice husks, because we had nothing to eat. The rice husks that were prepared and were being taken back to Japan for cattle feeding. I started to eat some of those in this hold, and I looked up and I saw a plate, and on the plate was this ship had been built by John Brown in the Clyde, I think it was, had the nameplate on it, in 1923. And just that moment I looked up, and I saw somebody battening down the hold, because I rushed up quickly and got out on deck again. And all the POWs, I couldn't have cared less, like, when the ship was in this typhoon. But we did notice the Japanese were walking around with two hats on and two pairs of shoes, one pair of shoes around their neck and one pair of shoes on their feet, and extra rice and stuff. Well, they thought they were going to go to heaven. That was their custom. They thought they were going to go to heaven. So they were walking around near the lifeboats, because the ship by then had been washed onto the shore and had washed onto some rocks, and we could feel it grinding as it settled itself down. And we then went berserk ourselves, and we couldn't have cared less. So we rifled all the Japanese clothing, which was downstairs in the hold, all their clothing, all their some were even doing kind of a knitting that the Japanese were doing, the sailors were doing, and the soldiers were doing the kind of knitting. We even stole that, and because we knew that, you know, the ship was going down. And anyway, when it did eventually settle down, the ship, and we could see about a couple of hundred yards away. It was on some rocks. I think it was Formosa. We could see some inhabitants on the island. And then when the Japanese realised the ship had settled down, they said, they got bold, and they said, whoever's taken all that stuff, better bring it back and put it on the deck. Otherwise, they wouldn't be responsible for their actions. And so they said they'd start shooting if we didn't put the stuff back. So we put the stuff back, and in the meantime, they'd got in touch with the Japanese Navy. And we were 2 days on this ship. We were just looting everything we could find. And we were 2 days, and the Japanese Navy came along and put loads of small boats out for us. And in the meantime, we saw lots of Japanese who had been hit by the American submarines in the convoy. They were floating by us with all their gear on, their life-saving gear. They were floating by us, and we just looked at them nonchalantly and couldn't care less. But then, as I said, the Japanese Navy came along and took us off, and during the night time, and they put us in these small boats, and they rowed us, and there was a destroyer there, and it was all bamboo all round the destroyer's guns and things, which was all stripped down like for lightness on the destroyer. And we thought we were back in the British Navy again, because some of them were dressed just like our own naval men. Some had moustaches, and they were definitely more humane than what the Japanese soldiers were. And they gave us dry biscuits, and they then treated us, you know, pretty good. And they took us to to a place. I think it was Osaka, or a little port near Osaka. And there we were fumigated before we got in Japan itself. We were fumigated and washed down, and then we went to the Osaka camp itself, where we're told we'd be working in a factory that did a lot of smelting, iron ore smelting.
Can you tell me what happened to you there?
Yeah, this was October then, and we found, coming from the tropics into Japan itself, we thought it would be a land of cherry blossoms, we were told. But when we got there, it was terribly cold, and we began to wish that we were back in Siam, because we had more freedom there in the jungle than what we did in Japan itself. But we were issued with winter clothing and told we'd be working in a factory which was attached to the camp. It was owned by Mitsubishi or somebody like that, and the work in there was they were making nuts and bolts and things, and the workers there were surprised, and they were very cowed. We used to start at 7 o'clock in the morning, March 7 o'clock in the morning, and when we got there, the workers would all line up. There was a kind of a canal outside, and the workers would all line up and face the canal, because the factory opened onto this canal, like. And then they turned to them, they'd bow and they'd say a prayer to the sun, and then they'd say a prayer to their machines. In Japanese, they'd ask their machines not to break down, as it would impair output. And then they'd all go back to their machines, but they'd seem to be losing heart then, and we tried to dodge work as much as we could. We used to try and hide behind machines, but it was so cold. And we were so hungry that time used to drag more than what it did when we was working on the railway. And one morning at 7 o'clock, all the, the Japanese workers were around a fire that was in a tin, and holes inside the tin, and it was cold in the tin, and they were squatting down warming themselves, and they spotted the owner, and he walked up the aisle, and he had a cauliflower ear. I'm always remember had a cauliflower ear about 4 inches on one side, and he walked up the aisle of the factory, and he spotted this fire, and we spotted him, and so did the Japanese workers, and he came straight over, and he kicked their backsides for them, and kicked the fire over, and they ran for their lives, because he was the owner of the factory, and they more or less were downtrodden, and it was terrible to see the poverty they were in. Because in the mornings when we used to come to work, we used to struggle sometimes. This is going back to the Kempe time. We used to struggle sometimes, and one morning some Japanese civilians broke through our ranks, and as we were coming out from the factory gates. The Kempe Tai came from across the road. They were across the road somewhere, and they got all these Japanese civilians, and they dragged them. They said something to them. They dragged them along, and they plonked them outside the guard room, and for breaking our ranks. And when we came back that night, about 6 o'clock, they were still outside the guard room. The Japanese civilians still standing to attention because they'd broken through our ranks. And if the Japanese civilians, we'd notice if the Japanese civilians. The women and children had spotted the Kempe Tai, or even the military, and they didn't stop and bow to them. The military or the Kempe Tai would come over and give them the ticking off, or maybe push them about and tell them not to do it again. And we could then feel sorry for the Japanese civilians because they were so downtrodden. And on a Friday night, we used to have a laugh because the inflation was so bad there, and money was no good. A Friday night, about 5 o'clock in the factory, the foreman would shout out, Hashimoto, he'd say, hui! And he'd go up and he'd get his week's wages, and he'd come back and he'd say, look, Tojo Brisento, and the week's wages was consisted of sweet potatoes and dried seaweed. And he'd come along and he'd say to us, look, Tojo Brisento, please, there's anything that he'd got this 3 weeks' wages. Look, Tojo Brisento. And we'd say, if I took that out of my woman on Friday nights, then I'd be a bleeding row. And then they used to have a boy of about 10 years old, some boys of 10 years old, standing on boxes, working lathes. And we used to have to take orders from them, which was humiliating. And if we didn't move quick enough, he'd throw a spanner at us. Like. And then even when we had a chap who learned himself Japanese characters to read, we used to steal... We used to steal a paper from the Japanese workers' pockets, and he'd read the paper silently. We'd give it to him, he'd read the Japanese characters, and he could tell us what was happening in Europe about the invasion by the Allies in Normandy, and that used to cheer us up quite a bit. And then we had heard that Hitler had committed suicide, and we got a bit confident then, and we'd say to these Japanese workers, Hitler dead. And they say, Japan fight. Then they go back and they say, remember the repulse of the Prince of Wales, which was the only victories they could give us, which happened in 1942, when they sank the Prince of Wales and repulse. They say, Japan sink the Prince of Wales and repulse. Japan fight on. Well, we did get a one or two air raids from the American Air Force. And just before that, on the November, it was cold. I looked up in the sky. I saw just the sun was setting. I saw about seven or eight planes, and they were like flying pitchforks going along steadily. And they were American B-29s. And then we could hear the crunch of the bombs as they attacked these ports somewhere in Japan. And that was the first one we've seen. And it's a sight I never forget. Like as the sun was setting down, it caught the glint of the American planes, B-29s going across. And that was the first Allied planes we'd seen for years. We knew then that sooner or later something would happen. And working one day in this factory, we were shoveling some coal into a crane, and the crane would come along and come down, and we'd shovel the coal into it, and the crane would go back again. And while we're waiting for the crane, to us to refill the crane with the coal, we leaned back against the wall, and we found that the wall was beginning to move. And it was a terrible feeling you can't describe. and their stomach seemed to be turning over and going round and round. And we looked up and we saw some factories moving, swaying from side to side, big chimneys rather, from side to side. We looked round, we saw all the Japanese rushing out into the open ground, and we rushed out with them. And then we looked up and we saw there was all the ground was opening about 2 or 3 inches. And that night,
this was an earthquake, was it?
Yeah, and we said, "What's happening?" I said, "Earthquake." All men outside into the open. And we went outside into the open, and when the earth had, when the earth had stopped shaking, the sea had come in from the canal kind of thing, and when it went out again, it left all dead fish, which was no good to us because we couldn't, the Japanese were doing our cooking for us, so it was no good to us, so we couldn't eat those fish, whereas in Thailand we could have done. Anyway, that night we went to sleep on our rice mats, and it was one continuous round of from the POWs, cough, cough, all night long. It was, coughing, and chaps running to the toilet, the dysentery and everything else, and, I was cold, I got pneumonia, and I was working with pneumonia, actually. The human body can stand a lot, because I felt ill one day, and I saw the doctor, Dr. Longbottom, his name was, and I saw him, and I said, I felt unwell. He said, "I think you've got pneumonia." I said, "But I've been working with you for 2 days, because it had been snowing, and we had no boots or socks on. It's amazing what the human body can stand, really." And he told me I must rest, and I was resting, and with that I got yellow jaundice, and my friend Paddy I was still with him. He had to go out catching food for me again. Like, he had to try and get me jam if he could. He got some jam from somewhere. I had that. Some sweets. It had to be sweet stuff. And after that, I began to feel this pain on the back of my neck. And it was a big, large lump was coming up. And I saw the doctor, and he said, "Yeah, that's a carbuncle. So come along tonight." He said, "And I'll..." And when the work's finished, he said, "No, I'll cut it for you." So I said, "Well, it's not ready for cutting yet, doctor." He said, "That's my decision to make." Anyway, I went into this room, and all the other POWs was having stuff put in their testicles, vitaminosis and stuff, and skin diseases and dysentery and everything else. And I bent my neck down, and he took this knife, and I could feel the cut searing the flesh open, and all the pus and stuff, burst out of it. And I had to go and see some Japanese girls. They were working this factory, and when they saw my neck, they started to giggle and say, "Look at that!" Like, and that humiliated me all the more. Anyway, I had to work with it. They put some bandaging around it for me, and every time I put the pick up, the back of my coat touched the carbuncle, and the pain was terrific. But that was one of the things that you got over, because you had to. And you still worked. You still had to work on with it. The work there was very, very hard. Because the chaps were still dying of different diseases. And in the mornings we had to pray in the cold. And you could stand behind. I stood behind some POWs one morning as we were being counted in Japanese. And I could. And if you moved, you had to number in Japanese, and if you moved, they'd come up and give you a clout. And I could see these lice, they were in the back of his... I could see their heads going in the back of his neck, and I felt like, going over and pulling it out. But I didn't, because if I moved, I'd have got a clout. And it was so cold that when we put our blankets out, because the lice used to seem to get... the lice seemed to get up in every little turning of your shirt or your coat, every little turn up they could find, they dug themselves in there. And if you put you got lousy and you put your blanket out on the line in the cold in Japan, and when you looked in the morning, it was all the lice were stiffened out on the blankets. And then when the summertime came, you get the fleas, big red fleas, start spreading all over the place. And the smell of the bugs and fleas when you crack them was something that wasn't very pleasant. And the factory workers were all really cowed. They just had nothing to eat themselves at all. And so we felt the only ones we felt sorry for was the ordinary workers.
Um, Can you tell me how you came to be released?
Yeah. I moved on then from Osaka to Nagoya. And I went into a factory. And things were getting very tight in Japan because they had no food hardly for themselves. So if you didn't work, you've got no food. It came to the point if you didn't work, you didn't get any food. So the thing was that you had dysentery, and they run out of rice more or less themselves, and it was mostly a bean diet because the beans aggravate the dysentery. But if you didn't work, then you got nothing. So you had the dysentery and the beans as well, and because we were all losing weight. I was down about 8 stone. This is in Nagoya, and we were in this factory pushing. We had to fill these big trucks. They run a single line, and we had to put iron ore in them and push them up to be smelted. And there was one Japanese worker there, a foreman, and he was a real so-and-so. We used to call him Tarzan. And one day he caught some American smoking. And I was with him, I don't smoke. But he caught the Americans, and he was very cruel. He gave the Americans a beating, and myself as well, although I didn't smoke. And when we went back to camp, they said, who was smoking today? Well, if they caught you smoking or idling, you stood outside the guard room, because many chaps have been outside the guard rooms all day long through some misdemeanor or other. Standing at attention in the cold, so the Americans wouldn't open up. So I said, "Oh, it was me, because I was tired. I want to get back into the hut." So instead of coming up and giving me a good hiding, he just said, "Well, don't do it again." The guards did, much to my surprise, and he let us get back into camp. Well, days were going by, and we were all near enough on our last knock-ins. We used to come back for a dinner about 12 o'clock for lunch, or so-called lunch. And I was stretched out on my bed, like lying on my back. And we'd had this, as I said this before, in the morning, a foreman had given us a good idea of smoking. And was lying back. And the Japanese camp commander, we used to call him the one-armed bandit. He lost his arm in China somewhere. And he was put on guard duties in this camp. He was in charge of camp. And we were lying about 1 o'clock, I suppose. And He came along shouting out, "Shigodo, Shigodo," it means work, Shigodo. So we got up and crawled back, like, outside. And just as we were getting up off our bunks, we heard some Japanese martial music playing. And we looked out, and we saw the guards, and they were all going, "Hey!" to heaven, like, with their rifles and the emperor. We heard a voice speaking, we didn't know it was the emperor. And we thought that was funny. This voice was talking, they kept on bowing and saluting to the sound of the radio. And this chap who we got the papers for, he said a couple of days before that he thought that the Japanese were protesting because a bomb had been dropped, and it wasn't a bomb, that ordinary type of bomb that was killing the Japanese in thousands, and they were protesting. But when we heard that, we said, "Well, so the so-and-so is right, for letting have a bomb dropped on them, the way they've treated us." But because we didn't know it was the atom bomb. But anyway, we were going to the factory, and we just on our way, and some Japanese children under a school teacher threw stones at us, and we didn't know why, but the school teacher gave them some word of command, and all these stones came at us. And because on our way there, we were hungry, we'd dived in picking up potato peelings from the side of the road, and thinking we could find, because we were hungry. And when we saw these Americans, they shout out from distance, "Put those shovels down, you! It's these bastards' turn now. It's these bastards' turn. Put them shovels down, Limey."
Anyway, what did they mean by that?
Well, they had evidently heard that the atom bomb had dropped before us, the Americans, you see. But we didn't know, because we were still going back to work, and we'd been beaten up in the morning by the Japanese foreman, you see. So we thought, well, they couldn't have packed up, otherwise we still wouldn't have got beatings up like that. And anyway, we saw because the kids threw stones at us as well. And the Americans said, "Put those shovels down, you bastards. It's these bastards' turn now." Well, when we got to the factory, everybody was nice to us in the factory. And they said, "Oh, you can go home now, back to the campo." And we went back about 4 o'clock, and we'd never known to go back early like that before. And then